I want to talk about the structure of the Hubbard model pairing interaction. And I think there's always a question as to what is the pairing mechanism and what is the pairing interaction. And in general, this is decided not by theory, but by a combination of theory and experiment. And certainly the last word is experiment. However, it does seem to me that as theorists, we ought to be able to understand what the structure of the pairing interaction is in a given model, particularly the models that we've looked at for, two, three decades, depending on how you count, all the way back to where Phil in 1959 proposed that this was a way to understand super exchange. And then Hubbard and Gutzweiler in 63 were using this model to talk about metal insulator transitions and ferromagnetism. But even among the set of people who believe that the Hubbard model somehow contains a lot of the essence of the cuprates, there really are different views about what this simple model does to create the pairing. One of these early views was the RVB view, in which there are resonant valence bonds that start off in the system, and that the purpose of the doping is allowing these objects to be free. And this was a view put forth in a famous paper by Phil in Science. There was, it happened, at just about the time of Bednords and Mueller, there was a set of work being done that focused on another class of materials, heavy fermion materials. And the point of view taken in this work was that it was associated with short-range anti-ferromagnetic fluctuations, and it was the exchange of these fluctuations that provided a pairing interaction, and that this exchange would give rise not to S wave, but to D wave. And there were calculations that came along a bit later that involved the anti-ferromagnetism as playing a major role in spinning whatever superconductivity you had off of it. Okay, that brings us toward the present, and I think it can be phrased as Phil phrased it in Science. The model that I'm going to talk to you about, which is the Hubbard model, has a very large U. This U, if you had a system in which you had one electron per site, would cause you to either have an electron up or an electron down. And as we know from 1959, that there's a virtual process back and forth that goes as 4T squared over U and gives you an exchange coupling and leads to anti-ferromagnetism in this half-filled Hubbard model. As far as pairing goes, I think it took a while for the community to decide what was the piece of the pairing that was important, but it was a near-neighbor interaction. And if you were to factor it, you would find one form of it would give rise to D wave. I'm sorry, let me go back for just a minute. The U here sets a scale, sets a dynamics for J. And if you want to imagine that somehow J is going to be frequency dependent, you better be willing to live on a scale of frequency that's of order the Mott gap, it's of order U. So it's very flat in frequency, and hence it's instantaneous. And the point here of the picture is that with a very large U and a very large J, those should dominate the problem. With the dynamics set by U, the interaction is non-retarded, and whether one would speak of a glue or not, one certainly wouldn't speak of a dynamic glue. Then we get to the mouse. And here, the picture of the glue bottle, which I think is important, in the early version of this, involves some type of spin fluctuation exchange. I suppose Burke Schrieffer it goes back to. And the main point I make of this one picture is, and what I think is very important in this problem, the same electrons that are pairing, the same one that are coming in this particle-particle channel, those very same electrons are the ones making the pairing interaction. And I think that allows the system to be more intimately coupled than if you thought somehow you had to have one system that was, I don't know, the boson or whatever you would call it, and another system living off it. These are the same objects. You're just turning your head. Instead of looking in, someone help me, the T channel, you look in the U channel. I don't know. But you look in different channels of the four-point interaction to determine what's happening. And there's just one breed of fermion that plays a role in this. And very roughly, this interaction is characterized by some coupling constant in low order by susceptibility. This quantity is something that could be measured in neutron scattering. All right. So then one might say there's a pairing glue. And now the question is going to be, and we will get there, but we're going to go through a few other things, is what do you find if you do the best calculation you can on Hubbard? It's not a question yet of what you find experimentally. That's going to be discussed, I guess, this afternoon. This is more what do you find in this model that we've all been looking at for a while. In order to do this, we're going to do as Phil says. We're going to Las Vegas. We're going to use some quantum Monte Carlo. And there's an early technique here pioneered by Mark Jarrell. There's a technique here Gabby talked to you about, pioneered by Gabby. And these are techniques that allow us to look at embedded clusters and to try and understand in more detail numerically what's happening in these models, in particularly the Hubbard model. So here is the Hubbard model. It's well known. A good bit of the talk until I get to the end will simply be the simple Hubbard model, in which there's one electron hopping between sites on a two-dimensional square lattice. There's an on-site U, and so there's two parameters, U over T and the doping. At the very end, I'll show some data from Tremblay's group in which there's a T prime, and things have been adjusted to try and model LESCO. All right. Now, I show this particularly for Phil. And the reason is, this is mostly where we're going to be operating, with a U of about 8 of order of the bandwidth. J of, okay, it's about a half. If you're half filling and you begin to cool it, you can say, what's beta? Beta is 1 over the temperature, and my energy units are the hopping T. So at beta of 1, we're up about 3,000 degrees. And by beta of 8.5, we're finally moving towards room temperature. But what's happened at N equal 1 is we've definitely opened a Mott gap. Okay? So there's no question that we have lower Hubbard, upper Hubbard. And if you look carefully right in here, that's spin fluctuations. That region is set by J, or 2J. So we're seeing the scales come into this. And now we begin to dope it. As we begin to dope it, we pull weight out of the upper Hubbard into the lower Hubbard. There are peaks here, finally get down here. But there is an asymmetry. Okay? So it's not that these calculations don't have that feature. They do. All right, now what is it we really want to look at? Okay, for this talk, what we're going to use is one form of Monte Carlo or another to calculate a four-point vertex. Because we have half an hour, we're going to limit ourselves to looking at it in the pairing channel. So I'm going to come in on this channel. I'm going to look at it with zero center of mass zero center of mass energy. It's only going to be a function of K and K prime, except K is both a momentum and a Matsubara frequency variable. Okay? So we're going to extract this. And furthermore, what we're extracting is the irreducible particle-particle vertex. The way this is done in the Monte Carlo is you calculate two-particle, two-particle Green's function, and a one-particle, one-particle. And by putting those together, you can pull out the irreducible interaction, which means this interaction is the sum of all Feynman diagrams that you cannot cut this way by cutting two lines and separating it. All right, so what is it we want to study about this interaction? We want to look at a number of things. We're going to look at its momentum transfer dependence. We're going to look at whether it carries a particular quantum number. Does it carry spin 1, spin 0? Can you identify what spin it carries? We're going to look at its frequency dependence. We're going to look at its strength. How does its strength vary as we change some parameters? Okay. All right, the momentum dependence. Here is a rough sketch. This is the momentum transfer. This is the strength of the pairing interaction versus Qx, Qy, the momentum transfer. And it tends to peak out at large momentum transfer. All right, this is just a sketch. I'm going to show you Monte Carlo data running out along a distance where Qx equals Qy. We're going to run along this axis, and we're going to look at what happens to the interaction. Now, you're going to say, you don't have much resolution. That's true. This is data, Mark can help me. It's either on a 24, this is probably data on a 24 site embedded cluster. So you're trying to represent all of your Billowan zone with 24 sites. So it's coarse. But I think what you can see is as you cool it, and I should caution you, this one I believe we were using a U of 4, half the bandwidth. Most of this will be U of 8. You can already see it's somewhat enhanced, but it's pretty flat when it's hot. As you cool it, I hope you can see that what it's doing is it's picking up strength out at pi pi, and again, is this pi pi? No. This is some section of a zone I'll show you in a bit. Well, what's the point of this? Well, the point is roughly this. The structure of the pairing interaction in momentum space peaks somewhere out around pi pi. If you Fourier transform that and say, okay, what does that mean in real space? All it means is that you have attraction at near neighbors. It's, in some crude sense, a giant Fidel oscillation. This is a calculation. It's a very old one. This is actually quantum Monte Carlo done by Nejat Balut on an 8x8 lattice, and we never could get it terribly cold, but we could calculate this interaction, the pairing interaction. We could Fourier transform it. If you put one spin, say, up at the center, and now you try and put another spin there, you can see you pay a terrific price in units of the hopping. It's very repulsive. But if you put a spin up here and you were to put a spin next to it, I hope you can see it's attractive. So this is attractive at short range, and it's what's giving the D-wave pairing. All right. Here's the experiment that I always wished we could do on these, but I certainly don't know how. In high energy physics, you know, you could take a target, a particle coming in, you could scatter, and you could ask about the quantum number of the object that was transferred in the scattering. Well, I'd like to know the quantum number of this interaction. Okay? I'd like to know whether a quantum number is spin 1, then I'd say it's antiferromagnetic spin fluctuations. If it's spin 0, I might say it's charge fluctuations. All right. How do you do this? Well, it happens the irreducible interaction for this spin rotationally invariant system can be broken down into a fully irreducible piece. It's irreducible in all possible channels, which are all possible channels. That's what this guy is. This guy is a guy that is a two-particle channel and another two-particle channel, which because of the spin rotation invariance, I can break up into something that carries spin zero, a charge part, and something that carries spin one. So, it's discussed by various people, well known. Now, what we're going to do is with Monte Carlo, we're going to calculate this. We're going to calculate this and this by looking at the same thing we got here, just in a different channel. We have these as Monte Carlo Green's functions. So we can calculate this and this and that. Then we can subtract and get this. All right. So there's a spin zero piece, a spin one piece, and now let's look at them to see what they look like. All right. There's the full interaction I'd shown you before. This is an interaction where, as we said, as you go out to large momentum, you go to low temperature, it's getting strong. What's making this strong? Well, let's look at the irreducible piece. The irreducible piece is a vegetable. It's not that it's not big, it's just that when you ask, is it going to have any overlap with cosine kx minus cosine ky, it's not. Okay? It's dumped. That's the magic of the D-wave. It avoids this rather repulsive interaction. Then let's look at the charge fluctuation, S equals zero. Well, it's a bad guy. It's going the wrong way. It's going to create repulsive new neighbor, but not very much. There's the S equal one. Okay? So, this is being caused dominantly by the exchange of something carrying spin one. Yeah. I'm sorry. The y axis is very small. It's the strength of the pairing interaction. And positive is good. Yes. Why is positive good? It's the old statement. Positive is good because when you Fourier transform it, it gives you very repulsive onset. But you go next, and there's this huge, oscillation. The part that's flat in momentum space cancels out if you put it up against a D-wave. It causes you it doesn't help you, but it doesn't hurt you. All right, now there's another way to look at all this that is a little simpler. This interaction we talked about has both momentum K and energy omega, and it has outgoing relative momentum K prime and energy omega prime, and so it's got all these variables. But a simpler thing we know to do is talk about the Bethe-Salpeter equation. We talk about what below TC would be the gap, but here it's just Bethe-Salpeter amplitude. And we know that the behavior of the interaction is mirrored in the Bethe-Salpeter gap amplitude as a function of momentum and frequency. So we're going to do the same thing here, but we'll go through it briefly. So this is what we're going to calculate. You got to solve the Bethe-Salpeter equation. We have this from Monte Carlo. We have these from Monte Carlo. We can solve the equation. And what comes out is somewhat interesting. You don't get one. You get a whole list of eigenvalues and eigenfunctions. We want the leading instability, but along the way at high temperatures, you found some peculiar beasts. You find S wave, triplet, odd frequency gaps. You find P wave singlet odd frequency. But then as you lower the temperature, the winner comes up, and it's the D wave one that I'll show you. So you can look at the leading eigenvalue. When that eigenvalue goes to one, you expect an instability. You can look at the structure in phi, which is like the structure in the gap, and it's going to have both momentum and frequency structure. Okay, here's the eigenvalue. As it's cooled on down, this is U of 8. This is a foresight embedded cluster. This is a filling of 0.85. And you see this is rising, but it has yet to go superconducting. Nevertheless, at this point, you can start to get an idea of the structure that's going on. And the structure. Here I'm going around the Fermi surface, which I don't have up here, I should have. Remember, if it were half filled, the Fermi surface would look like a diamond here. I'm walking around looking at the points, and this is cosine kx minus cosine ky on the grid I have. Now, you can look at this four-point interaction, and you can come in different channels I told you about. You can come in the particle-particle channel, which we talked about. That's the blue line, okay? You can ask about charge. You could come in that channel and ask for the charge fluctuation. It's not doing much. You could look sideways, come in the particle-hole channel at momentum pi-pi, and you would pick up something very large, which is the antiferromagnetism. And look what's happening. The antiferromagnetism is rising, but something's quieting it here. What's quieting it is the superconductivity is going to take over. This gives you an idea of the crudeness, or put it this way, of the limitations of what is a difficult calculation. These are the points, the grid that we get information on in this calculation. All right, let's go to the coupling strength. How does all this depend on U over T? Where do you want to be? Now maybe we come closer to the conference. If you were designing this, where would you put it? All right, so this is the coupling strength. What this is the D wave eigenvalue as you cool it, and this is for U equal 4T. Well, it's rising. When you go to 8T, it's rising, it's bigger. You go to 12T, and look what's happened. You're starting to lose. It made U too big. Makes a lot of sense, actually. Once you start making U too big, this is going to come down, because among other things, J goes like 4T squared over U. Now we have the doping dependence. All right, what happens here? You run the calculation at different dopings, and you cool looking at something that I'm afraid I took out of the slide, but I'll tell you what it is. It's this four-point interaction, which, remember, depended upon K and K prime. On both sides, it's projected with a D wave, cosine KX minus cosine KY on one side, cosine kx prime minus cosine ky prime on the other, summed on the Brillouin zone on both k and k prime, and it gives you the strength of this interaction. And the strength of this interaction is interesting. At a doping of 0.85, well, it rises. At 0.9, it rises. At 0.95, it's rising. It's getting stronger as you're pushing nearer and nearer this instability. On the other hand, what's happening at the same time, I may have pulled that because of time, what's happening at the same time is the weight, the renormalization and weight of the quasi-particles you're trying to pair is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and they're just going away. And so the interaction's getting very strong, but there's nothing to pair. I did pull it. All right, now we come to what I believe is important also, which is the frequency dependence. So far we've looked at various parts of this interaction. Now we're going to look at the frequency dependence. All right. Right now, we don't have the greatest handle on it in what I'm going to show you, because what we have is this gap function as a function of the Matsubara frequency omega n. And you know, that's awful. You really wish you had it analytically continued down onto the real axis. But we have it in omega n. Let's take a look at it. The good news is it's even, which it should be. And so here you have various Matsubara frequencies at this temperature, and these frequencies, you know, are 2n plus 1 pi t. And so here they are, and here's what this function looks like at a k value that has put you out near the antinode. So you're out where the gap is as big as it can be, and now you're looking at its frequency dependence. And now you cheat with an adjustable setting of how you set this on. you look at the spin fluctuation, pardon me, the magnetic spin susceptibility at pi pi as a function of omega m, a boson Matsubara frequency, and you say, well, they look like each other. But we all know that that's a tough game to play. Why is it tough? You're looking at some things along an imaginary axis. You wish you had them on the real axis. So what really happens? Well, following this, there was various work. What I've decided to pick here is the most recent work that I believe shows the type of thing that happens. This work is by André-Marie Tremblay and a group. And what it is it's one of the cluster Monte Carlo calculations. It's a four-site embedded cluster in which they calculated the self-energy of the Green's function in the superconducting state and pulled out the imaginary part of the anomalous self-energy. So what is this? This is delta of K omega, and it's the imaginary part. In an ordinary superconductor that has phonons, you get both real part of the gap and imaginary part of the gap. They pulled out the imaginary part of the gap, and they plotted it for some parameters in their model that made it look like LSCO. The U is a T, there are some T primes. It's done by this CDMFT, but it's an embedded cluster technique. They're able to work on the real axis. And now it gets tricky. I didn't make that big enough. But this, I got you. This is the imaginary part of the gap at the antinode. And now what's happening? What's happening would be a little easier to see if I showed you this. What's happening is they're running at different dopings. So here's a very low doping, if I could read it. 0.04. Okay? So this is a very low doping. There's a large peak here in the imaginary part of the Q-integrated magnetic susceptibility. So this is what you see in neutron scattering if you summed overall momentum. There'd be a large peak, it would come down, and so forth. Now, they increase the doping. Here, you've gotten to dopings 0.26. Here, you've gotten some dopings that are colored red where they find no superconductivity. You've doped it so severely. At any rate, as they change the doping, the peak drops in the magnetic susceptibility. On the other hand, in the anomalous, or put it this way, in the imaginary part of the gap function, they also find a peak. They find other structure. Now what they've done is they've mapped wherever this peak occurs in the imaginary part of the gap, they've drawn it down so you can see these lines. What you should see is these lines apparently follow this line with the gap getting slightly smaller. Remember, there's always going to be a gap shift here because you've got your boson and then you've got to feed the gap into it. So you always have that. But that's the type of correlation they're seeing in a numerical experiment linking the imaginary part of chi to what's seen here. Okay, so the conclusions before I get to Mike's questions. I think the effective pairing interaction for the 2D Hubbard model increases at large momentum transfer and it leads to an attractive near neighbor D-wave pairing. It's dominantly carried by spin one. It's largest for U of order the bandwidth. It increases as n goes towards 1, and it is retarded on a scale set by the dynamic spin susceptibility. Okay, let me address Mike's question, and then we'll be finished. So, I believe there is pairing glue in the Hubbard model, and it reflects the spin fluctuations. It's important because these spin fluctuations are made up out of the same fermions that are pairing. And in that way, this is a rather unique and different system than we've been used to. This is why the coupling, I believe, is so strong. Now, why is it important? Why does anyone care except two of the speakers? I think it's important because it reflects how we think about this, one of the simplest models that we're using to represent Marvin's Class II materials, the zebras. It suggests that in thinking about these materials, we might focus on the antiferromagnetic spin fluctuation spectrum. And that while these are near Mott physics, the important physics from the point of view of the pairing is the spin fluctuation physics. I think the spin fluctuation approach provides a unified view that allows us to look all the way from the heavy fermions, where the idea originated, to the actinides, to the cuprates, and now to the iron nictides. Question, will there be a test of this experimentally? Well, we'll see some this afternoon, I think. But will there be signatures? Well, what I have shown you in the last slide is strong signatures of something measured in neutron scattering, because the chi double prime I showed you was a Monte Carlo calculation done by Tremblay at the same time he does the superconducting calculation, okay? So there's no perturbation theory or RPA or approximation. It's the same level of numerical calculation. And he found them related. My belief is that we'll find them related experimentally, but it's a tricky business because there are a lot of other things happening in our system. There are potential stripes, there are potential surface effects, there are inhomogeneity effects, there's the pseudo gap. None of this is saying that's not there. In fact, in the numerical Hubbard model results, as Gabby showed you yesterday, you pull out a number of those things. It's just that today I've spent the time looking at the interaction. Collective modes. Certainly, there are various calculations that found that if, with a certain momentum transfer, you change the sign of the gap, that would mean your neutron scattering would show you a resonance. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that it's spin fluctuation mediated or anything else, but it does mean that that's the behavior the gap has. This is what I believe, though. I believe that when you see pi-like resonances, it means you have a gap that's changed sign. And at least as far as I know, the most natural way that we have of understanding gap like that changes sign on different parts of the Fermi surface or on different Fermi surfaces suggests that it's electron-electron interaction. This is just a plot by Christensen. He put on one of the iron materials. This is the resonance peak versus 2 delta log-log plot. And suggests that not only heavy fermions and cuprates, but these things fall on it. Finally, collective excitations. I've talked about one, which was the pi-pi resonance. But there's another one, possible at least. And you look at the new iron superconductors. It appears from spin fluctuation calculations on those that there is an attractive pairing channel in both the A1G and the B1G case. In that case, we have a real possibility that something we looked at for a long time and never seen, which is you go in the superconducting state, you take a couple of those quasiparticles, and you let them loose, and they bind into a Cooper-like pair, only it's of a different symmetry. It's an excitonic Bardasis-Schrieffer mode, and it was discussed first by Wu and company as being able to see it in Raman, and then Devereaux and I looked at it, and thank you.
Do you know anything, what you would get if you did your calculations on a highly frustrated lattice, like the Kagame lattice, where you could still easily form singlets, but you wouldn't have pi-pi order?
Catherine, I don't, but Tremblay again and his group, I think, have a paper in which Gabby is here, and maybe he could, or if he is here. Gabby, doesn't Trombley and you guys have a paper in which they put on some T primes, they put...
Does it enhance superconductivity, or does it suppress it? Frustration. So some frustration actually helps, but not fully frustrated.
Doug, in your papers, you at least mentioned that there is a non-retarded component to this.
That's protection. Right. In calculations that Mayer and I did, which I didn't have time to describe, in which we used a dispersion relation to relate the real part of the gap at low frequency to the integral of the imaginary part of the gap over omega, and try and understand where was the juice coming to make up the low frequency gap. We found the dominant weight was coming out of spin fluctuations, even in a TJ model. Paul LeBlanc got involved in that. But as we went up to higher frequencies, comparable with excitations to the upper Hubbard band, we found an additional instantaneous contribution. What we found interesting was, you know very well, an electron phonon, there's the retarded, and then there's the coulomb that hurts you, although you get a mu star and it's not as big as you think, but it hurts. In this case, what we found was the instantaneous part of the interaction also helped.
So when you conclude now that it is the retarded part that leads to the pairing, why have you thrown out the...
Because the retarded part in all our calculations led to the dominant part of the pairing. And there is now some differences between what Trombley found in his calculations and slightly different from what we found. Okay? But the dominant, there's no question in these numerical calculations where the dominant part of the pairing is coming from. It's coming from the mouse.
Doug, I hope you don't mind having a question for one of your co-organizers.
Not yet.
So there is a question that has been bugging me, and I know has been bugging you probably much longer, is whether does the Hubbard model really superconduct?
Okay.
And this is the elephant in the room
in my mind.
Okay. And you spent many years trying to see that in quantum Monte Carlo, and if my recollection was correct, was the D-wave susceptibility is the only one that was unsuppressed and had a modest growth at low temperature.
Well,
what is different between that and this?
I think that what happened is there was early work by people around me and in Santa Barbara in which we ran quantum Monte Carlo. And we were simply, because of the well-known sine problem, we were never able to get cold enough. So we never knew where it went, but we were always disappointed. We couldn't see it. We couldn't see this eigenvalue rise to one. Other groups, particularly sitting just back of you, Mark Jarrell and his group, did a very detailed calculation on different sized clusters using cluster dynamic DCA, cluster dynamic field approximation on clusters, and concluded that you could get it to go. Imada in Japan has written papers saying he does not see it go, all right? So do you need T prime? Do you need, I hope not, oxygen? Do you need slightly other things to make it go? I think different groups perhaps are of different opinion. I happen to believe what Mark has done. Yes, I should have, again, I had half an hour, I'll show it to you. You can take the earliest calculations that we ran and plot what the susceptibility is doing, and then we stop. We couldn't get lower on 8x8 standard Monte Carlo. And then we tack on what Mark and his group had been able to do, and it just continues on up. But we never could get there.
two guys, don't worry. Tom?
In your opinion, what's the physics behind this proportionality between TC, or the gap, and the magnetic resonance, or the peakiness or susceptibility?
The question is, in my opinion, what's the physics behind the peak and the susceptibility and TC? Sorry, one more time.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I did show a plot, and the plot I showed was a log-log plot of the energy of the resonance versus twice the gap. And roughly what's going on there is this resonance is associated with creating a couple of quasi-particles, and that costs you of order in energy 2 delta. It's a log-log plot. A harder question, which I think you were asking me, is there some relation between the resonant peak and TC, because the resonant peak contains, quote, spin fluctuations? I think there's very little, and the reason I think that was pointed out by Kivelson and Key and others, which is there's relatively little total weight in this resonance as far as driving the pairing. It comes along as a partial signature, but the real weight is the continuum of imaginary part of chi of q omega, and not just the resonance. It plays a small role in making it go superconductive.
Well, if you take the active part of the irreducible interaction that you've calculated, and because it's retarded, can you use something like Eliasberg and then predict the density of states and the self-energy for the delocalized quasi-particles?
So the question is, because you have a retarded interaction, and I keep telling you it's associated with the neutron scattering chi of q omega, can you make some Eliasberg-like predictions? I'm hesitant to get trapped into the word Eliasberg because it carries so many meanings to those of us who have used it off and on over the years. So can I predict the density of states and self-energy? Okay, I can if I'm running that program, and that's just what they do. In other words, right now we have no small parameter. But what we have are various numerical techniques that are continuing to improve, so that for simple models, like the model I showed you, if you went to Tremblay, or maybe it's in the paper that I referenced, and you said, okay, I've seen what Doug shows, I wish you would tell me what the density of states looks like, what something else looks like. The answer is, those things also can be obtained numerically. Now the question is, can you obtain them in some simpler, semi-analytic way? I mean, you have to understand, when I first spoke about the work Schrieffer, Wilkins, and I did with Eliasberg, the reaction I got was, oh, you put this in a black box of a computer and something came out. Okay, I assure you, that was the belief. Nowadays, we talk as if Eliasberg solving this nonlinear gap equation was so familiar to all of us that it's practically analytic. Well, right now, James, what we have is a black box, not so familiar to everyone. Gabby talked about it. It's going to become more familiar, I think, and it's quite useful. And if you give me that black box and a simple model, and you give me Gabby or you give me Mark, they can do the, you know. Mark, you can do it, right?
Don't commit yourself, Mark.
Can I have a piece of the blackboard as well? The thing I want to emphasize here is that I believe that Doug's calculations are absolutely right. I mean, essentially right. That he is calculating the things that he says he is calculating, and he is getting them right. What we differ on is what the meaning of that is. I can take my methods and calculate the gap as a function of frequency. And I can calculate the on a number of the other things that he calculated. I just realized as I was listening to you that I can calculate both the odd and the even part of the interaction. When I do calculate them, I have a scale that goes from omega equals, well, u and minus u. I get something that looks like this. What? Oh, this is the size of the gap, delta, and this is frequency. This frequency here is above the order of 3 delta, something like that. It isn't 3 delta, but it depends on the gap. It's roughly proportional to the gap. Sure enough, I've got odd and even. I've got about the same amount of variation. The average level or the low level here is roughly the same as your constant bit of the gap that comes from all frequencies. The problem is that, the fact is that it's very, very much simpler to calculate these things in the hidden space than it is in real space. It really takes quite a large machine and a lot of intelligence to calculate it in Doug space. In my space, I did this in a half an hour or so. And I got the same answer. So he's right, yes, of course he's right. He's just interpreting it as an interaction in a space where, in a different space, his electrons are just as real as my pseudo-electrons. But I just think they're a clumsy way to go about it.
I won't take it because of that. Okay. Well, I want to draw one more piece on here. Somehow the picture I have is that if we were to talk about the real part of the gap versus frequency, we know... Okay, so we'll take the real part. Somehow, if this were lead or something, we would be talking about something that had, as you know, we'd be talking about something that had in it structures that had to do with the transverse plus gap and the longitudinal plus gap, and there'd be structure in this. But this structure would tell us something about the underlying pairing interaction. My belief is that what I showed you that Tremblay calculated, that I'll draw your structure. I don't think it's quite what he gets. But that in that case, what this has to do with is structure in the spin fluctuations. And yours, I realize, has 3 delta in it because you can come along and you can decay. I understand. You can decay. I think this process, giving 3 delta, is different than what Tremblay finds, which has structure associated with spin fluctuations.
I would, of course, get spin fluctuation if I had put it in. There is a very large decay channel in which the quasi-particle spin up comes out as a quasi-particle spin down plus a spin fluctuation.
Right.
And this grows as you get deeper into the lower doping regime. It's practically absent, I suspect, in the very overdoped. But it certainly is a very large part of it, and it causes all the background. And of course, I would get imaginary parts.
Right.
I have a coherent peak. This calculation included only the coherence peak. And the background will give you your imaginary parts.
then what?
But I do not use the imaginary parts in any sense as a motivation for superconductivity. In fact, I'm sure that they detract from superconductivity.
I don't need it because I got my... Again, comment on that. I believe that within the framework I discussed, that there is... This is the Q summed on local susceptibility. That before you go superconducting, there's some spectrum that tends to look a bit like this, with this being omega spin fluctuation. And I believe that this is what is the dominant pairing. And so I know I just heard, Phil, I understand what you say, Phil, that you're going to pick it up as a scattering process. What I'm claiming from what we see in the Monte Carlo is that not only am I going to pick it up as some sort of scattering process, I'm going to use it, and as you heard, I'm going to claim it gives the dominant binding, and that without it, you wouldn't have your superconductivity. Furthermore, I'm going to claim that it's of some interest, because when you go superconducting, the D wave cuts a piece of this out because of the gap, and there's maybe structure in this summed, but not too much because of the resonance. The cutting of this out is what gives rise to the fact that instead of the gap rising in the usual BCS manner, as you scoop this out and you get rid of the bad pair breaking part, and you push it into the regime of good pairing, this thing rises much more rapidly, and it rises to a larger value of order 5 or 6. And I believe that, once again, that's due to the fact that the piece that the baby you want to throw out with this bathwater, the mouse, is causing the pairing. But I realize we differ on that.